You are listening to an American Free Press podcast.
Joining me on the line are Professors Paul Verhagen and Shelley Aikman. Professors, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you.
And professors, you are both married, aren't you?
Yes, we are, to each other.
Now, I read a study recently online, the headline being, "Everyone's a little bit racist, but it's not your fault. Blame TV and magazines instead, say scientists." I want to get into that in a couple of minutes, but before we do that, for the benefit of our listeners, could you explain what exactly you do over there at the universities that you're both stationed at? Professor Verhagen, you are at the School of Psychology at Georgia Institute of Technology, is that correct?
That is correct.
And Professor Aikman, you are about 50 miles away, you said, in Gainesville, is that right?
Gainesville State College, the School of Social Sciences.
What do you folks do at these respective institutions?
We're professors of psychology. This is somewhat of a strange study for us because I'm typically a cognitive psychologist and I'm interested in what happens to people's memory and attention when they grow older. So this is quite different from what I typically do.
My primary responsibility is teaching, but my research interests are also a little bit aside from this. I am interested in health and social psychology and the overlap of the two, primarily attitudes and then our attitudes towards foods, but attitudes in general, which relates nicely to attitudes towards people.
How did you get involved in this?
Part of it is just pure curiosity. I'm from Europe originally, and so one of the strange things or things that were strange to me that I started noticing was that when you teach students, they tend to cluster in groups. You have the black students in one part of the auditorium, the white students in another part, which to me always looked very strange. I also discovered that there's ethnicities that are important here that are not noticeable when you come from Europe. Somebody who's Hispanic just looks white to you. And those groups don't interact very much with each other. That seemed kind of strange. And then there's kind of two ways you can look at racism or two types of racism people have. One is the kind of very blatant stuff, I don't want to talk to you or I don't want to give you a job or if you move into my neighborhood, I'll move out. But there's also this kind of strange gut level racism that exists. It's the kind of stuff when you walk around at night in your neighborhood and you're white and you see a big black guy approaching you, you might have this tinge for a moment where you say, oh, I better cross the street. And then you catch yourself and you realize if I saw a white guy, I would not have this feeling. That this kind of gut level racism seems to be part of almost everybody's makeup, including black people. And so you do these kind of strange demonstrations in class with your students. And one day I had my students do one of those sneaky tests psychologists have to see how you identify with different groups. And so this test is trying to see how quickly you associate white with good things and black with bad things. And so it turned out that my white and black students did the test and the black students were very upset because they were finding out they were having a racist bias against black people just as much, well, a little bit less, but they also had that bias against black people that white students seem to have, which completely doesn't make sense. So we were thinking about this, and so it seemed to us that there was something there that really didn't make sense. Why are black people racist? Why are women sometimes sexist? Why do older people talk about their senior moments when they're really just too busy to remember stuff? So we seem to put ourselves down, even minority seems to put themselves down, and that somehow didn't seem to make sense to us. So I think that's where the study was kind of born.
I did look over the few articles that are out there on it, and I did kind of get the gist of it. From what I picked up from it was that you would give a word to a participant of the study, and I think the word was, in this case, GUB, G-U-B, which really isn't a word, I guess. And the folks would obviously not be able to identify that word, and then you would give a different word, GUN, G-U-N, and ask them what they relate to that word, and let's say it was violence. And then what you did was you put a picture of, in this case, a black person next to the word gun, and then they more quickly identified the word violence when they saw the photograph. Is that right?
We just used words. We had no photographs. So we used the words black, white.
Okay.
So we only used the words. Some early research did use photographs, not our research, but some early stuff looking at racism and climbing did use photographs.
Okay. So you had the word gun by itself, and then you put the word black in front of gun.
Reversed. It's the other way around.
Black, gun.
So you had black first, and you asked people, how did it go?
So the general idea with priming is you would put a word up first that you think will prime them to think one way versus another. So if you put up black, you assume that you're priming them to think of the stereotypes of black. So that when they see a word, if it fits their stereotype, like gun fits their stereotype of a black person, they'll respond more quickly because it fits their stereotype. if in the reverse you put a picture of a white or you say the word white and then give them a gun, that doesn't fit their stereotype. It takes them longer to say, oh yeah, that's a word. So the idea with priming is that you're basically making them think of all their stereotypes. You're making them accessible so that when the next word comes up, it fits the stereotype, they'll respond quickly to it. The idea for the study came from a talk we went to by Dave Bellota.
These kinds of priming effects or studies are a good way to kind of try to figure out what is going on in people's heads without them actually realizing you're asking them. So if you show people the word fire truck, it makes them faster to recognize the word red than to recognize the word green. Fire trucks make you think of red. If you show them the word black and then you show them the word gun, they tend to be very fast, faster than if you show them the word white and then you show them the word gun. So this is a sneaky way kind of to find out what people are thinking of when they're thinking of fire trucks or black or old or woman. But the really strange thing there is, again, that black people also associate black with violence and not white with violence, that older people associate old with wise or old with forgetful just as much as younger people do. And so we were thinking, so why is that? Because it's hard to think that older people are really ageist, that women really are sexist, and that black people really are racist. It turns out that you find kind of similar effects in cognitive priming, that is, when you're not interested in race. And so we started thinking, well, maybe what is happening is that what we look at in the networks that people have in their heads and the associations they have is not really something that they build up consciously over looking around the world and saying, oh, this is happening. But maybe it's just something that you just absorb from the culture around you. And so you associate fire truck with red because you see that associated a lot. Every fire truck you see in every darn movie you see is red. Every fire truck in real life is red. Not completely true. Airport fire trucks are yellow, but the ones you see in movies, the ones you read about, they're red. And you've read about them since you were 2 years old. So maybe black people are racist because whatever you read about black people seems to have associations, good or bad stereotypes, black and violence, black and poverty, or good associations like black athletic or black musical or black religious, and you just internalize those, you absorb those over a lifetime of learning. And that's not a very novel idea. Other people have come up with this as well, but nobody's ever really looked at it because it's actually hard to look at.
Mm-hmm. And I see here in one of the articles that you utilize something called Beagle, Bound Encoding of the Aggregate Language Environment. And it says here that it contains a sample of books, newspaper, and magazine articles, about 10 million words in all, thought by psychologists to be a good representation of works that are in the American culture. So what your study revealed is that the racism has something to do with the media. Is that right?
Yeah, I mean, it really does have to do with what you're surrounded with your entire life, what you've been reading, books, magazines, what you've been seeing on TV, but it's what's been surrounding you that you've just kind of absorbed those associations.
What the people who came up with Beagle did was just look at this big, what we call a corpus of data. So it's books, it's textbooks, it's articles from the New York Times. It's all the stuff that you would expect the average undergraduate to have read by age 20 or so. What they just did was look within those texts, how often is black paired with poor or black with violent or black with religious or old with wise or old with forgetful. They just look at all those 10 million words and how they are connected. So we were kind of trying to find out if how those words were connected would predict how well or how fast people would be on those stereotype priming tests. So maybe you're faster to associate black with gun because black and gun very often co-occur in texts or in movies you see or in the internet. And it's not just that black makes you think of gun, it's that you've, again, absorbed all of this stuff that you read and looked at and just spit that back out once we put you in front of that computer.
So the racism you're saying isn't something innate, it's something learned from the media.
Well, again, there's two types of racism, right? But this kind of racism is something that kind of implicit is something that you learn from the culture around you, the media, the books you learn as kids, maybe also, of course, the experiences you have. And so in a strange way, then, that actually means that it's not you who's racist, it's the culture who's racist or sexist or ageist.
How much of the media reporting actual events, for example, the violence in the black community, statistically is a lot higher than the violence in the white community? Now, you're from Belgium, right?
Yep.
Are there many black folks in Belgium? I've never been there myself.
We have a large North African population.
Okay. Is that the case in Belgium? Is violence in that community a lot higher than violence in the indigenous populace?
No, because the means of violence differ. There is much more emphasis on gun control in Europe, so you actually have much less violence because of that.
Mm-hmm.
It's harder to strangle somebody than to shoot somebody, right? So the threshold for violence tends to be higher.
Is the violence higher in that community?
Not
that you're aware of. Okay. Here in the United States, the statistics are showing that the violence is a lot higher in black communities here than in the white communities. Could the racism be attributed to the fact that the violence is reported by the media, and that's what is actually being manifested? Of course, the media could be not telling the exact truth. That's always the case. But could it be that it's not so much that folks are racist because of what the media says, but they're racist because the media is just simply presenting what's happening?
That's a chicken-egg thing, right? The media have a large role in there. And to the extent that the media reflect what is happening, your inner representations will reflect what's happening. But it's also very easy to distort that. Propaganda is a very good example. For about 8 years, we've been told that President Bush was dumb to the extent that this is one of the first associations that comes up now. He has a degree from Yale. He's probably a standard deviation or more above the mean in intelligence, but we've indoctrinated to believe that. Or Obama is socialist. He's just a socialist, I guess, as Bush is dumb. So you're told over and over again, and that this is true, and so you internalize this. And that's kind of independent of the question of whether it's true or not. It's one of the reasons, for instance, why propaganda works. It's one of the reasons why some people insist that you should be politically correct, because then you don't reinforce those stereotypes.
Mm-hmm. And what was the most surprising part of the study for each of you? Something that was uncovered that you didn't expect, perhaps?
Not sure it's that we didn't expect it, but the idea has been posited so many times that culture is playing a role in this implicit racism. It comes up again and again and again that it's really just a reflection of what we've learned. And the fact that we could actually have a really nice, neat, clean way of measuring that, using the Beagle scores and using these associations and culture to actually show that it does explain where these findings are coming from.
What was most surprising for me was that because we used these primes with people, but we also used words like summer hot or night moon or cat evil, that there was nothing special about the words black, white, old, young, male, female compared to summer or cat or dog or night or day. Because I think kind of implicitly you assume that the kind of reasoning we make about people or the opinions we have of people or the prejudices we have of people are special because we are in a human environment, but it turns out that they're actually not. You reason about people just the same way you reason about everything in the environment around you. And so these stereotypes aren't anything that's actually really specific to groups of people. They're just words that you associate things to. And I thought it was a very strange conclusion for me to see, especially because you assume that because humans are such social animals, that there would be something special about the social environment. But it turns out there's not.
So theoretically, if, let's say, media did not exist, or we lived in such a world where we did not communicate, and we passed a guy on the street who was black and we were white, we wouldn't go to the other side of the street. Is that what you're saying?
If you live in a community where you are 50-50, that would be the case, I think. It would be completely determined by your own experiences and not by the experiences of others.
Right.
That's why they're called the media, right? They mediate what the world is to us. If that disappears, then it's your own experiences that drive this.
Right. So without the media, there might not be any racism if you didn't experience it.
Well, media also means books and picture books and television shows and all that kind of stuff.
Right, so exactly. Without any media.
This would reflect your own experiences.
What do you think, Shelley?
I find it hard to tease out the media. We are in a society where there's constant communication. So whether or not it's your own personal experience or what you've heard from other people, if there's any idea in society that one group is different from another group, and that's human tendency to say you're not me, therefore you're different, you're going to pass those messages along. As long as we are categorizing, which is natural human tendency, we're going to keep going over stereotypes, maybe at a smaller level. I'm not willing to say that media is the cause of all stereotyping or racism. Word of mouth would also. If there's anybody who has a bad experience and then shares it with somebody else, the experience gets shared.
Right. Actually, that was just in the news, I think, last week, that word of mouth is the most popular form of spreading news. Did you happen to see that?
I'm not surprised.
Would this have predictive capabilities, you think?
It certainly would, because if you know the associative value of two words, you would be able to see how fast people would react. But it's only predictive, really, at the gut level. That's important to see, too. Now, I can say, oh, I want to cross the street. I can decide to cross the street or not. If I am prejudiced against hiring women and somebody comes into my office and is looking for a job, I can realize that, hey, maybe I should really look carefully at her resume before I say no. So there's what happens at the gut level, and then there's what happens above that. Now, revolutions are interesting because they are, I think, absolutely gut level. They very rarely happen where somebody decides, oh, let's start a revolution, let's have a plan. It's just an uproar that just happens. You have the Tea Party, or you have the Belgian Revolution, or the French Revolution, and there you go. So those would be very nicely predicted, I think, by looking at what is happening in the media.
And of course, the Wall Street protests that are happening now and spreading across the country, and of course have the potential to spread across the world. Are there any warning signs in your study that you think would make sense for folks to pay attention to that you might have uncovered?
Warning signs?
Is there something you might want to tell folks to be wary of?
Well, political correctness is a good example, right? This is one way in which you try to engineer somehow in the media what is happening and how particular groups are portrayed. The study, I think, shows that there's a good potential for good or bad in terms of social engineering. I guess I already gave the example of propaganda. You hear a lot in the media these days about that seems to equate Muslims with terrorism. If you repeat that over and over again, we have a large Southeastern student population on campus, that those students are suddenly all very dangerous, which is not the case. There's 20 people who hijacked a plane. There's millions and millions and millions of Muslims. So the media do play a role there, I guess, in spreading ideas. And the more often you repeat simple ideas, the more likely they are to seep into people's minds. Mm-hmm. So this can be used for good or for evil. And what is good and evil to begin with? That also means, I guess, that if you work in the media, you have that responsibility. If you're a consumer of the media, and there's about 360 million of us in the United States, that you have to be careful about what you are being fed in the media. And one part that kind of concerns me there is that there's also research out there that suggests that certainly now with the internet, more and more people are kind of getting insular in what they read. And so you have a particular cluster of people that reads conservative media and a cluster of people that reads liberal media. They don't cross-read each other. And you start having gut-level reactions about people of the other camp, which is another particular strange consequence, I guess, of the two-party system you have in the United States, where it's then easy to put yourself into one camp or another. And so we lose that dialogue. And I really have no answer to how you can deal with it, except that you should look over the fence. But it turns out that if you look over the fence, literally, your neighbors are also likely to share your political convictions, because people actually tend to group themselves by political conviction in neighborhoods as well. So it becomes very, very hard to escape the brainwashing of your own in-group that seems to be happening over and over again, which would be a wonderful follow-up for this study, I think, actually.
Shelley, did you want to add anything?
I'm in complete agreement.
What you were saying about the media, you brought up, for example, the demonization of Muslims, and you were referring to a large Southeast Asian population of students, is that right?
Yeah, we have a lot of Pakistani students, for instance, a lot of Muslim students.
Right. And of course, they're just regular people like the rest of us. But in this case that you brought up, or this particular example that you used about the 19 hijackers, what happened a few days after the 19 hijackers were identified, 7 of them came forward and said, excuse me a second, I saw my picture on TV, but I'm here, I'm alive, it's me. That story was buried in the media. There are a large number of very educated folks who do not believe that 19 Muslim hijackers living in a cave in Afghanistan were able to shut down the entire air defense of the United States using box cutters and a satellite phone. And the Twin Towers came down by fire, which has never happened with any steel frame building. So there's a perfect example. Perfect example. The most significant event of the 21st century, where most people believe, still believe, that 19 cave-dwelling Muslims did 9/11. The media is hiding the information. Did you know about those 7 folks who came forward?
I've heard reports of that, and I've also heard that that's been debunked in the meantime.
But that's the extent of it.
Yes.
How about you, Shelley?
I have not heard about it. No.
Okay. And did you hear about the 200 Israeli spies who were arrested prior, during, and after 9/11, who were living in close proximity to the hijackers? No, because the stories came out when this happened, but the media then buried it or eliminated it. So you're right. The media is something that should be paid close attention to. And the only reason that I thought about it is because you brought up the 19 hijackers, which after, for myself at least, studying it and researching and spending all the time I do on it, 9/11 is not something that was done by Muslims, which is so ironic because since that date, most people have their focus on Muslims as the enemy. And so these poor people have to live through this every day of their lives now, that the majority of the United States is focused on Muslims as the perpetrators of this event. And they're not. At least, again, in my research and studies, it's shown that it's not. And that ties into your studies, because we could look at not just the racism of blacks, we could look at the racism of Muslims. Could a study be done just on 9/11 through the media and how it's affected Muslims?
Sure, and it probably should, and I assume it has.
I'm sure there have been a lot of studies looking at attitudes towards Muslims, but I'm not familiar with any of them.
Mm-hmm. Any closing thoughts? How about a follow-up to this study?
We actually have been talking about it, but we haven't settled on what we want to do next.
I'm actually very intrigued with your idea that there's ebbs and flows in media, right? Stories that surge and then stories that disappear. And those stories have associative stuff to them as well. Muslims are terrorists. Obama is a socialist. Obama is born in Kenya. George W. Bush is dumb. And so it might be a great idea to actually follow over time how much that impacts people's kind of gut reaction to politicians, to political issues and things like that. Although that could be used as a dangerous study, I guess, in the wrong hands, propaganda being what it is, the media being what they are. But I think it's very interesting for them. For me, actually, one of the main things to take away from this study is, again, those two levels of racism or sexism or ageism. And that if you feel a tinge of fear, if you see a black person or next time you see an older people and you think automatically they're helpless and you need to help them across the street, those feelings are normal and we all have them. And it's what happens after that that is the really important thing. I tend to feel guilty a lot. It must be my Catholic background, I guess. But you shouldn't. That kind of monster inside all of us for many of those things is not really a monster of our own making. It just shows that, I guess, you're American or you've lived long enough in the culture. It doesn't dissolve you of responsibility either, but it should free you from feeling guilty about this and being able to, I guess, meet people face to face as humans rather than as representatives of a group.
Right.
I think also the awareness that that should bring, that what you say does matter and that what you do matters, that at a gut level, you're going to have the feelings that you have. What you do next has an impact beyond that.
I guess that's where the golden rule comes in, right?
Indeed. It's there for a reason.
Right. Exactly. Professors Paul Verhagen and Shelley Aikman, I want to thank you so much for the time you took out today explaining all this to the listeners, and looking forward to your next study.
Wonderful. Thank you so much.